From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Do you know the name of the man who built much of downtown Los Angeles?
A lot of the most iconic structures in Los Angeles were created by a son of a mill worker who really had this very improbable rise, part by good fortune, part by sheer determination.
Later in the show, hear from the director of the first ever documentary about architect John Parkinson. But first, Los Angeles needs to build more housing. Many Angelenos need help paying the mortgage. Is the solution to both in our backyards?
Your house can have a baby. You can make the baby work. In an R1 zone, you are allowed in the state of California to turn your garage into a habitable dwelling unit. It will be an accessory to the main house. That is why it's called an accessory dwelling unit, or ADU.
On today's show, we'll hear about efforts to make ADUs, accessory dwelling units, a common sight in Los Angeles.
There are approximately something like 50,000 unpermitted units in Los Angeles alone. People need these units, whether it's for, you know, to rent out or for personal use. We need them now. We need the housing.
This is the second show in our series, This is Home in LA, from the tent to the Giga Mansion and everything in between. Thousands of Angelenos already live in or rent out a little house in their backyards. To date, you've known them as granny flats or in-law units. Unlike, say, a backyard art studio, these have a kitchen, a bathroom, and a living area. Many are illegal.
I didn't want to lose this house. And I had to figure out a way to pay the mortgage.
That's Ira Belgrade speaking to CBS2. After his first wife died, he built an unpermitted unit in his backyard in Hancock Park. That was in 2009. He wound up in a lengthy dispute with the city, and then he became one of the leaders in the fight to get the laws changed around ADUs. Here in Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti listed ADUs among his housing priorities in his State of the City address last year.
Now, this is Los Angeles, so you better believe we're getting creative about how we build and preserve affordable housing in City Hall. We're letting more homeowners build in their own backyards to open up more affordable living spaces.
While some cities statewide have embraced ADUs, others are pushing back. State Senator Bob Wieckowski, a Democrat from Fremont, has led the charge in Sacramento to make it easier for California homeowners to construct backyard homes.
Everyone from the business groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the architectural folks, environmentalists are all lined up in support of the legislation to liberalize and modernize the rules around ADUs. It's simply the curmudgeon city planners and attorneys and council members that want to have complete unfettered control over people's houses.
So ADUs represent a chance to add value to one's property, and unit by unit, they could help solve the region's housing shortage without altering the character of LA's single-family neighborhoods. That's according to Dana Cuff of UCLA's City Lab.
What I've been working on with my students and colleagues at City Lab is inventing ways to develop housing that's really in keeping with the suburban fabric. And that's the granny flat or secondary unit or what we call a backyard home. Los Angeles has 500,000 single-family lots, and we could solve Garcetti's 100,000 units of housing with just 20% of those.
In January of 2017, a new California state law took effect that encourages homeowners to build granny flats. Cuff and her students have produced a guidebook called Building an ADU.
So what we're trying to figure out is how to give homeowners the ability to basically be their own developers and put houses at this lower scale.
Are you ready to build a baby home? Will you pay off the mortgage with a revenue-producing rental? Or could you end up reliving the 1980s Tom Hanks movie, The Money Pit? In a moment, we'll visit a couple that took the plunge into building a new ADU. We'll also hear from architects and techie dreamers who see ADUs as the new frontier for design innovation. First up, though, let's start with those illegal ADUs.
I get probably 3 to 5 calls a day. I get a bunch of hits on my Yelp page.
Dionne Payne is a longtime building contractor. She started a business 16 years ago called Illegal Additions Made Legal.
I am known as a problem solver because what do you do when your largest asset is encumbered? Building and safety is breathing down your neck. They're giving you fines. You have an illegal addition, and now you get hit. Because the single largest issue with an illegal structure is liability. You are exposed. If somebody slips and falls, your insurance company may not pay for their damages.
Now, new accessory dwelling unit laws have lifted requirements for setbacks for parking and for passageway. But even with these constraints lifted, there's still a lot of head scratches about how to make your garage conversion habitable.
Habitability means insulation, electrical, plumbing, foundation, all the rules that change your garage into a dwelling unit. Most people are clueless when it comes to what the rules of habitability are.
Are people also coming to you as they purchase a new home and kind of in advance finding out what the rules are for the ADUs?
They are the smart ones. If you're going to spend $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, $1 million for a house, make it work for you.
That's Dionne Payne, founder of Illegal Additions Made Legal. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. And now let's turn to building a new ADU. The city of Los Angeles wanted to figure out what this might involve for a regular Angeleno homeowner. And to do so, it needed a guinea pig.
I'm on Gilcidio's mailing list, so I get a newsletter about things that are happening and relate to our district, which is CD1. And part of that mailing list about 2 or 3 years ago was, do you want to build a house in your backyard? I had always looked at our backyard and thought, oh, we should build something back there. I followed up with the email address and that link, and here we are today.
Here is a concrete foundation and slab built onto a gently sloping backyard of a bungalow in Highland Park. Trent Wolby and Grace Lee own this home. 2 years ago, Cedillo's office in the city of LA, helmed by the mayor's innovation team, selected the couple to test build an ADU. Cedillo's office gave funds and the city brought on board a handful of nonprofits, designers LA Moss, builders Habitat for Humanity, and financiers Genesis LA. Here's Grace Lee.
The purpose of the entire project was to push policy, right? And it was to re-examine the current policies and how they reflect how people are actually living in LA these days. Mm-hmm. And so part of it was to look at, are the setbacks, do those still make sense in our current condition? How does the zoning work or the code?
Now, there were aspects of all this that was exciting, and there were some unwelcome surprises for the team. Here's the team's engineer, Liz Malo. She's co-founder of Naus Engineering.
The tricky part about building on a hillside that is not ever really included or it is hard to estimate from the beginning design phase is the extent of the foundations that are required. So, and that was exactly one of the issues in this hillside property was it was permitted through the city, but then once you start excavating, you're always finding surprises.
Such as, in this case, looser soil than anticipated, adding costs and time. Then there were design challenges, like conforming to local preservation requirements. Here's Helen Leung. She's co-executive director of LA Moss.
Trent and Grace's home is in a historic preservation zone, the Highland Park Garvanza Historic Preservation Overlay Zone. That's a mouthful. It's an HPOZ, and HPOZs are actually very prohibitive as it relates to the exterior design, the form, the elevation, the size. So the existing home is craftsman style. So we've walked a fine line where we tried to meet all the standards, making sure it was craftsman inspired, but add a little bit of flavor that wouldn't raise too many eyebrows.
Now, according to the architects, they chose materials that would meet anticipated HPOZ rules, and that added an extra $20,000 to $30,000 in construction costs. There were also custom design features, and those add costs, and a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
We had many goals, one of which is how can we design an ADU that is contextual? How do we build an ADU that is affordable? How do we innovate on a financial process? How can the city shape their new policy and program? And how can we deal with the city's often long permitting process? All while knowing that Trent and Grace had to pay for the construction themselves.
Now, people are looking to build ADUs for various reasons. For Granny, as an Airbnb, as a home in order to rent out the front house. But the city sees these as a means to providing affordable housing. The Mayor's Innovation Team and the county's Homeless Initiative are also looking to ADUs as a possible means to house some formerly homeless in exchange for financial incentives to homeowners. Could this piecemeal approach produce affordable housing? Helen Leung of LA Mass says yes.
Cities currently get their affordable housing stock through the affordable housing industry, and that takes a lot of time and money. It's reliant on tax credits. Because it's so complicated, they tend to be mixed income, mixed use, high-density projects that sometimes, if it's near transit, can cost $500,000 per unit. And with ADUs, you're saying rather than rely on an affordable housing developer, a nonprofit, an average homeowner could, for just as little as $150,000, be able to provide a unit of affordable housing, but they can also build equity on their property.
Is that how much Trent and Grace's house cost? Just $150,000?
No, theirs is a little bit more. I would say $150,000 could be for a 600-square-foot single-story ADU on a flat site. Their house was significantly bigger. It was over 1,000 square feet, and it also had a 200-square-foot garage, which doesn't count as square footage. It's two stories at HBOZ, so theirs is an example of one that is a little bit more intense. I think the cost would be a little over $300,000 total.
It's building a house, isn't it? We keep calling these ADUs as if they're somehow different, but all the tasks involved, all the challenges are the same as if you were building a house. Is that fair to say, Liz?
Correct, yes. As far as structure is concerned, it is a house.
What I would say is that building in LA is difficult, and that's why this program exists.
Back to Trent Wolby and Grace Lee.
We've really learned so much from everybody involved in the project about just how complicated it is, and we're really happy to be a part of that process because we were lucky enough to buy this house in Highland Park at a time when you could actually buy a house in Highland Park and not be rich, basically, depending on what your notion of rich is. So I think in the long run, we'll get there, but there's so much to learn. It's super interesting to see like the inner workings of how all of these things come together and why, really, at the end of the day, developers are the ones who do a lot of the building because it's a very complicated process. It's not to be taken lightly.
You chose to work full on with the bureaucracy. Can you now see why people sometimes might actually sort of want to keep it on the down low?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, it needs to be easier to build a house in LA. Everybody would tell you that, from the city to my cat, you know? Like, it's just hard. And while I think a lot of the laws that are in place were done with great intentions, they were also, I think, made when we didn't have an unaffordable situation in the city. We're liberal California people, you know, so we totally identify with all of the environmental stuff. But, like, there's some stuff that just, it's overly onerous to the point where it detracts from quality of life for everybody here. And all of that stuff has to be rethought. It's my hope and my belief that after we get done with this pilot project that this will develop into a product. So I think that the sort of analogy I always make is we hear these ads for Rocket Mortgage on Quicket Loans, like push button, get loan. It won't be the same, obviously, but if we could get to a point where there's an app and you push button, get backyard house, that's the ideal, right?
That was Trent Wolby. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton, and we are talking about ADUs, or accessory dwelling units, as part of our series, This is Home in LA. Now, in talking to the designers and the homeowners, the HPOZ, or Historic Preservation Overlay Zone, came up several times. So are HPOZs a hindrance to building backyard structures? Well, yes, says Dion Payne, founder of Illegal Additions Made Legal.
I would never buy a house in an HPOZ. They want to know your underwear size. In some HPOZs, you have to do certain colors. Whatever you touch on it, it has to look the same.
We reached out to Ken Bernstein. He's the principal city planner for the Department of City Planning's Office of Historic Resources. And we asked him, are HPOZs going to restrict ADU construction? He says the pilot project in Highland Park is not typical of ADUs going forward.
It was this case that really got us as a staff looking much more closely at the changes in state law that went into effect at about the time that we were reviewing this case. So we are not looking at materials and overall design compatibility of ADUs any longer. We can look at whether an ADU might exceed the height or width of a main structure. So we are not imposing more kind of soft or subjective design review to ADUs.
Now, the legalization of ADUs has builders, consultants, and designers coming out of the woodwork, and it's generating some fresh ideas.
We make it really easy for people to build backyard homes, ADUs.
Alexis Rivas is the CEO of Cover. This is a company based in Gardena. It sells prefabricated ADUs that deploy computational design and software to streamline the production of the backyard structure. One of its investors was an early investor in Airbnb and Snapchat.
We take care of the entire process from the design stage to the engineering, permitting, manufacturing, delivery, and installation. We're the single point of contact for the client, and we're able to do that because we've developed the technology on the software side to make that permitting and design process really straightforward, really simple, and give the clients a fixed price up front.
So far, Cover has built backyard structures without the kitchens and bathrooms that make them full accessory dwelling units. Now they say they're getting orders for full ADUs, and they estimate that their product, made of panels of steel and wood or composite materials, would cost, if built on a flat lot, $300 to $375 a square foot. Meanwhile, Cover offers a useful free service. Go to its website, type in your address, answer a few questions, and you can find out if you can even build an ADU on your property and how big it can be.
We basically codified what the zoning actually does and doesn't allow you to do and what the exceptions for the different neighborhoods and different districts are, and process that information in a way and that using this tool, you can instantly understand the zoning that's relevant to your property specifically.
Now, Cover is by no means the only firm offering ADUs as a streamlined mass-produced product. Meanwhile, some designers have more fanciful ideas in mind.
If we made these ADUs to be somewhat pleasantly human-like or animal-like, with arms and legs and hats.
Jimenez Lai and his firm Bureau Spectacular were shortlisted in a recent competition that was run by the county called Yes to ADUs. The idea was to make backyard homes palatable through good design to Angelenos. Lai started with structures that are the opposite of mass-produced and standardized.
It is a source of identity. It is a source of identity for people to feel that this is what represents who they are.
So you were proposing anthropomorphizing your backyard building and what, making it look like a creature or just making the building fun?
Creature-like, and it's like cloud-watching, you know, you see what you want to see.
Jimenez Lai also felt that the basic premise of the ADU being a baby home that serves simply the homeowner could be turned on its head. How about instead having a lot of baby homes that all add up to a shared piece of local infrastructure?
So we're thinking, what if we introduced ADUs that are not just for residential purposes, but they are in themselves micro-mixed-use? And these micro-mixed-use, if the ADUs are considered infrastructural rather than just architectural, meaning, you know, if they generate electricity, if they process water, if they help with, you know, a kind of community fermentation station, some agricultural or other productive use meant for the block, not for the property.
That's Jimenez Lai. Now, concepts like his may be a little far off in the future. For right now, the goal is simply to get cracking with building some ADUs, have your home become an income generator and a participant in solving the region's housing needs. But does all this represent a change in the definition of home? Let's go back to Dion Payne of Illegal Additions Made Legal.
Life is to be lived. You have a house, make it work for you, so that you can go on about the business of living.
You're listening to DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. This was the second in a series called This is Home in LA, from the tent to the Giga Mansion and everything in between. Coming up after this break, the man who built LA's greatest civic buildings gets his due. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Buildings in downtown are climbing up and up, so it's hard to remember that 90 years ago, City Hall towered over the Southland.
We're on the 27th floor, the observation deck. You can walk around, there's 360-degree views. To me, this is the best place in the city if you want to show off Los Angeles.
This is Stephen G. He's a filmmaker and writer based in LA. We met at City Hall, the soaring structure of marble and tile designed by the team of John Parkinson, John C. Austin, and Albert C. Martin.
There was a lot of political fighting about, you know, who was going to design this building, you know, how much it was going to cost. But there was always an inevitable sense that it would get done because the city was growing so rapidly that it had to get done. When it opened in April 1928, population 1.4 million. The number of people that lined the streets for the parade was 500,000.
From the moment Stephen G left the UK and arrived in Los Angeles, he's been fascinated by John Parkinson. The man designed many civic buildings in Los Angeles. They include Memorial Coliseum, Union Station, Bullock's Wilshire, and most of the structures on Spring Street and many at USC.
A son of a mill worker who really had this very improbable rise, part by good fortune, part by sheer determination, to have a hand in many of the structures that were the building blocks of the modern metropolis that we consider Los Angeles now.
G also felt a very personal connection to Parkinson.
John Parkinson was from Scorton in Lancashire, and my father was from Lancashire. And I found it remarkable that an architect who came from the same place as my dad would basically design the majority of iconic structures built in his lifetime. I felt like they shared the same value system. You know, if you work hard, you get on. It's a very unpretentious lifestyle, you know, and you don't cheat anybody. And, even though Parkinson came to have enormous success in Los Angeles, you know, I think he stayed a pretty humble guy.
But Parkinson, in Stephen G's view, has been woefully underappreciated. And for the last 8 years, he's been working on a film about the architect. To get support, he determined he first needed to write a book on the topic.
I sent a letter to a publisher, the Angel City Press, that published these wonderful books on Southern California history. And, you know, on their website, it said, we'll get back to you in 2 to 4 months. And they came back to me the next day and said, we didn't believe you when you sent this letter that this guy had done all these things. We had to go and Google it. So anyway, I did that book. The other books came about as a consequence of that book. But it's taken me about 8 years to finish a documentary on Parkinson.
Why had he kind of disappeared from the history books?
Well, I think a number of different reasons. Firstly, you know, John Parkinson's son died pretty early. Donald Parkinson died when he was 50. The grandson was, in the family's mind, supposed to take over the firm, and he died very young as well. So there was nobody really to champion his legacy. Also, I think everything started over fresh after the Second World War, and a lot of the styles that John Parkinson had worked in had been forgotten. But also, you know, Los Angeles has a very peculiar relationship with its history anyway. It's not really known as a city that spends a lot of time looking backwards. And I think perhaps that's beginning to change. I mean, there's always been people that have appreciated its history, but perhaps now there's a few more.
Stephen G wrote, produced and directed the film. It's called Iconic Vision, John Parkinson, Architect of Los Angeles. And this Thursday evening, it gets its first screening on PBS SoCal. The documentary tells the story of a young man who sailed for the US in 1883 with $5 and a toolbox. He worked his way into becoming an architect, first in Seattle and then in Los Angeles. By 1915, Parkinson estimated his firm had designed 80% of the modern office buildings in the city. Here's a clip from the movie from historian Kenneth Breisch.
I think the irony of Parkinson's career is that he created these monumental, iconic buildings and structures in Los Angeles that have come to define the city. But he was working concurrently with the sort of darlings of architectural history and criticism, Richard Neutra, Rudolf Schindler, Frank Lloyd Wright. They are the architects, because they were modernists, who've gotten all of the attention.
G scoured archives and Parkinson's family scrapbook to tell the architect's story.
It's really told through a blend of sort of contemporary imagery, but also some remarkable archive footage. We have John Parkinson's home movies, which to me was such an enormous, significant find, because, you know, when I did all this research, you see these very stoic posed photographs from the 20s when everybody looks very serious, and then suddenly you had this black and white footage of him moving around, and it's really hard to describe how that affected me, because it goes from being a great story to being a great story about somebody who really lived. This documentary, you'll see footage of City Hall under construction. You'll see footage of the Colosseum under construction. You'll see this remarkable parade when City Hall opened. You see a remarkable parade when Union Station opened. When you put all those significant moments in Los Angeles history into one place and say they're all connected to the same person, then you kind of get the significance of it.
You've said that generally John Parkinson was a good person, but still, were there any kind of idiosyncrasies or kind of funny stories about him?
Well, I mean, one of the things that always made me laugh, that the story in the family was that his wife was so much better at math than he was. So when it came to working on a particularly complicated structure, he'd take the plans home at night and work at them in private with his wife, who'd do all the, you know, the harder math side of it. But I think it's interesting when you look at him coming from such a humble background, who has a son who becomes an architect, who grows up in the 1920s and is friends with all these film stars, friends with Amelia Earhart, drives super fast, extravagant cars, that there's a real contradiction in the firm between this very, you know, working class boy and then the son who has everything. Has the MIT education, you know, has the celebrity friends and designs these modern, exciting buildings.
But that's also a kind of a story of immigrants to America, isn't it? The hardworking immigrant that comes here through their toil, does well, and then the children play.
I think the children, in John Parkinson's case, certainly did play very, very hard, you know, but I think one of the things I really love about Parkinson's story is that it existed in a very slim sliver of time where really there was a sense in Los Angeles that anything was possible. You know, you watch the old Harold Lloyd movies from this period and you see in the background that Los Angeles is one giant construction zone. And to think that here's John Parkinson, who's the preeminent architect at a time when Los Angeles, you know, really is deciding what kind of city it wants to be. It's really inventing itself, and there's riding, you know, the crest of a wave in history that will never be repeated.
That's Stephen G. He's director of Iconic Vision, John Parkinson, Architect of Los Angeles. The film will premiere this Thursday evening, July 5th, on PBS SoCal at 8 p.m, and then it will air nationally starting July 7th. That's it for today's DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.